Today on Renewing Your Mind.
This is the wonder of the atonement, that the Father accepts in our behalf the payment of a moral debt by someone else.
That is the good news of the gospel, our moral debt paid by the perfect life and sacrificial death of Jesus. We're glad you've joined us for today's Renewing Your Mind as we continue exploring what our triune God did to provide salvation for us, something theologians call substitutionary atonement. It's a controversial doctrine in some circles, but in his series, The Atonement of Jesus, Dr. Sproul answers the critics and explains the death and resurrection of Jesus. We're offering all 10 lessons from this series, and I'll let you know more about that at the end of the program today. But now let's listen to Dr. Sproul and his lesson titled, A Redeemer.
Jesus told his disciples that he was going to give his life as a ransom for many. And the paying of ransom is something that we normally associate, as we've seen, with kidnapping or with hostage maneuvers and so on. But there is a different motif associated with the ransom concept that runs deep in biblical history, and it's an idea that is often overlooked in our day. And to get a handle on that, I want to direct your attention today to some rather obscure passages in the Bible that you may find strange indeed. The first one is found in the book of Exodus, in the 21st chapter of Exodus, beginning at verse 1. I'll ask you to bear with me patiently as I read this brief text, because it will seem so strange and foreign to your ears that you might have a tendency to be engaged in wool gathering and allow your mind to wander. But stick with it, if you will, for a moment. Chapter 21, verse 1 of Exodus reads as follows. Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then the master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Now, that passage is so completely strange and foreign to our culture that we have to ask ourselves, what in the world is going on here? The first thing that kind of offends our senses as we read this is the biblical law with respect to slaves. We thought that the Bible advocates redemption from slavery. Well, slavery, as we know it in our history, that involved man-stealing and just taking people and separating them from their husbands and wives and children and putting them into shackles and chains and so on, is not what's going on here. This is a different kind of slavery. This is what's called indentured servitude. Now, here's the background for it. In the first place, Jews were not allowed to enslave other Jews, like was done in the case of military conquest, where people were reduced to the status of slavery. But there were provisions for indentured servitude, and these were based upon the economy of the day. If a person incurred a debt that the person could not pay, he was not thrown into prison, but rather he more or less hired himself out to the person to whom he owed the obligation and became a servant, and he was paying off his debt with his labor. Now, the debt could be small or it could be large, and it could take a few years to discharge that debt. And the laws of Israel required that in every sabbatical year, no matter whether the debt had been fully discharged or not, in terms of the length of service, still that indentured servant had to be released. And the same was true every 7 times 7 in the year of Jubilee. And that's what these laws are concerning here. But what I'm interested in this text is not so much the principles of indentured servitude as such, but the business that we find in this text about servants with wives. There seems to be something in this text that seems horribly harsh to us. Let's look at it again. We read in verse 3, if he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. That is, after he's paid his dues and worked off his debt, he's free to leave. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. But if his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Wow. Doesn't that sound like cruel and unjust treatment? The idea here is the man owes his master a debt. He's not able to pay the debt, and so he becomes an indentured servant, and he comes in single. He doesn't have a wife. But then the master gives him a wife. And the man marries this woman, and he has children. And now he fulfills, after a period of time, his obligation. He pays off his debt, and it's time now for him to be released. And he wants to go. Well, the question is, can his wife and children go with him? And the biblical answer is what? No. Why? Well, the answer is simple in Hebrew terms. Because he hasn't paid for them. A man had to pay a dowry to the father of the bride in order to get the hand of that daughter in marriage. And if this man is in debt and has no means to pay his debts, he certainly doesn't have the wherewithal to pay the bride price. That's what it was called. It was called the bride price. And so this servant who has been working to pay off another debt incurs still more debt when the master graciously and freely gives him his daughter or one of his female servants as a wife. So if the man who now has the wife and the benefit of marriage and the children, if he is going to be able in his freedom to stay with his wife and children, he has one of two options. The first is he goes out by himself and now earns a livelihood, comes back to the master, and now pays the bride price, and at which time, after he pays the bride price, he can receive his wife and his children, and they will live happily ever after. If he has no means to earn a living afterwards, and he wants to stay with his wife and his children, he can extend his indentured servitude, now not to pay the original debt that he owed, but so that he may pay his master the bride price. But what I want us to understand here is the whole concept of the bride price, which is crucial to the Jewish society of the Old Testament. Now, there's another closely related custom in Israel, and that is the custom of the so-called kinsman redeemer. The kinsman redeemer is a relative who can be authorized to pay off one of his relatives' debts, including the bride price. Let's see where we find that established in another somewhat unknown text in the Old Testament, in the 25th chapter of Leviticus, where we read In Leviticus 25, beginning at verse 23, these words, "The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possession, you shall grant redemption of the land. If one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possession, and if his redeeming relative comes to redeem it, then he may redeem what his brother sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself becomes able to redeem it, then let him count the years since its sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it." Now, all of these instructions about slavery, about the sabbatical year, about the year of Jubilee, are all tied up with this concept of kinship redemption, where it is the custom for the family to take care of the debts of its members. They didn't look to the government to bail them out. If one member of the family became poor and had to sell off part of their possessions, then the kinsman could come and pay the price that was owed and redeem that property back. There's one little book in the Bible, the whole story of which is a drama centering on this whole practice of kinsman redeemer. And it's the story, the lovely story of Ruth. Do you remember that story? The book of Ruth is kind of special to me. I have a wedding ring on, and just recently my wife and I celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary. And in my wedding ring, there's words inscribed. And the words are simply these: "Your people, my people." And if you would look in my wife's wedding ring, you will see inscribed in her ring, "Your God, my God." These are words taken from the book of Ruth, when Ruth pledges herself to her mother-in-law, Naomi, and says, "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Your people shall become my people, your God, my God." And there is a whole drama of kinsman redemption going on with Boaz and so on in that story. Now, the language taken from these transactions and these customs are applied throughout the scriptures to the work of the Messiah in his atonement. In the ransom that Christ pays, he does two things. One, he works as the elder brother for his people. He is our kinsman redeemer. He pays the indebtedness that we incur before God. He purchases our liberty. He restores to us our inheritance in the Father's kingdom. He buys us out of indentured servitude by paying the price of our restoration for us, so that the ransom that he pays follows the custom of the kinsman redeemer. He is our brother, our elder brother, who purchases our freedom. But more importantly is the imagery that abounds in the New Testament with respect to the relationship between Christ and his church. The foremost image that is used for the church in the New Testament is that the church is the bride of Jesus Christ. The Bible uses this central image for the church, that the church is the bride of Christ, is linked very clearly to Christ's atonement, to his paying the ransom, the fact that he has purchased his bride. Again, our kinsman redeemer, our elder brother, who is himself the Son of God, has purchased us and our redemption. Now, when we talk about purchasing, We're talking about the exchange of money or of goods and services or of some kind of currency. I have in front of me a dollar bill. And as I look at this dollar bill, I see these words in small print on the face of the bill. It says, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private." What that means simply is this, that the government of the United States, by law, has declared that this piece of paper that I am holding, which has little inherent value as paper, nevertheless can be used as a medium of exchange to settle debts, private and public, so that if I buy a television set in a store and I pay the merchant with so many of these dollars, under the law, that merchant is obligated to receive this paper in payment for my debt or for the price, the purchase price of the goods that are bought. This transaction is called a pecuniary transaction, one that involves money or currency. And we have spoken already that in the atonement, Christ is satisfying a debt that we owe to God. But we must be careful to distinguish what kind of debt it is. And in light of the reality that the Bible frequently speaks of Christ's atonement in the language of commerce, of payment, of purchase, and so on, we may be inclined to think that the debt that is being paid is a financial debt, a pecuniary debt. But in fact, it is a moral debt. Now, my favorite illustration to indicate the difference between these two concepts is this. I was in a store once where a little boy came in, it was an ice cream store, and walked up to the counter and ordered an ice cream cone. And when the person behind the counter fixed the ice cream cone and handed it to the little boy, the waitress said, "That will be $2. And the little boy reached in his pocket and pulled out $1 and just handed it to the waitress. And she said, "I'm sorry, but you need two of these." And the little boy was crestfallen and he said, "But my mommy only gave me this $1. And so there was a problem there, and I stepped forth, as any parent would, right then and there, and walked over to the counter, pulled out a dollar from my pocket, and handed it to the lady, and I said, "Here, that'll cover the rest of what is owed." Now, here's my question. Did that store owner or the waitress have a legal obligation to accept my payment in behalf of this child? Can one person pay a financial or pecuniary debt for another? Well, the principle in our society is this: as long as the money is paid, the person who is owed the money is obligated to accept that payment that is rendered. And so the store owner really had no choice but to accept my payment of the debt that was incurred by this child. But suppose we had a second scenario where instead of the child coming in and ordering the cone, as I've suggested, the child comes in, runs behind the counter, steals two scoops of ice cream, and starts running out the store, and the owner grabs him and calls the police, and the police comes in and arrests the child for stealing the ice cream cone, $2 worth of ice cream. And now I step forward and say, "Just a minute, take it easy here. You don't have to arrest this little boy. I will pay his debt." Now, does the policeman or the store owner have a moral obligation to accept my payment? No, because now, in addition to the pecuniary debt or the financial indebtedness, there is also a transgression of the law.
so that now a moral debt has been incurred, and the person who has been violated is not required to accept somebody else's substitute payment. I use that illustration for this reason. In the atonement, Christ purchases our redemption. Christ pays the ransom. Christ pays the bride price for His church. But that payment is not of simply a pecuniary nature, but it is a moral payment in the full sense of the word. And in so far that it is a moral payment and not a financial transaction, God is not required to accept that payment. But this is the wonder of the atonement, that the Father accepts in our behalf the payment of a moral debt by someone else. In fact, it's by a someone else that He Himself has appointed for this task, that He has sent into the world with this mission in mind. So that in the agreement that we spoke of between the Father and the Father commissions the Son to buy back His people, to purchase their redemption, to satisfy their indebtedness, and He willingly and gladly makes the sacrifice to give that payment. And the Father now has His justice satisfied and His grace satisfied, so that in the work of the cross, we see the clearest example in all of Scripture of God's maintaining His own righteousness, His own justice, and at the very same time, pouring out the riches of His grace in our behalf. Christ has paid the price for us.
Jesus Christ, our Redeemer, paying the penalty for our sin while at the same time pouring out grace on us. Incredible, isn't it? We're glad you joined us today for Renewing Your Mind. We've been featuring Dr. R.C. Sproul's series, The Atonement of Jesus. We're airing only 5 of the 10 lessons, but we're offering the entire series to you for your gift of any amount. You can call us and make your request at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. The series is contained on 4 audio CDs, and we're including Dr. R.C. Sproul's hardbound book, The Truth of the Cross. It has more than 160 pages explaining the great work accomplished by Jesus through His crucifixion. Pairing the book with Dr. Sproul's teaching series provides a deep well of content to help you understand the atonement. Request them both with your gift of any amount when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. Just a note before we go that our 2019 Ligonier Ministries National Conference is coming up next March. It's not too early, though, to begin thinking about registering. We're offering an early bird discount rate through September 3rd, so contact us soon. You can find out more and register when you go to ligonier.org/2019. That's ligonier.org/2019. For a final thought before we go, here's Dr. Sproul.
Today, in our brief time of Coram Deo, I want to do something that I don't normally do. I want to call your attention to a teaching series that we have done at Ligonier Ministries, which has had one of the strongest impacts upon people of anything we've ever done. And this series is called The Cross of Christ. It includes some of the material that I've covered in these lectures, but much more than this. And we've had literally hundreds and hundreds of churches
who have used this video series on the cross of Christ as an integral part of their program of adult education, adult Sunday schools, or whatever. And if you have found this series on the atonement of Christ meaningful to your understanding of the Christian faith, let me encourage you, if your church has not yet had the opportunity to learn from this particular series, that you make it your personal duty and personal responsibility and opportunity to make it available to your church. That's how these things happen. When one person in the congregation is interested in the edification of the whole church, and they make these materials available. And so if you are interested in doing that, please be sure to call us at Ligonier today so that we can provide these teaching materials for you.
Well, so far in this series, we have learned that Jesus was our substitute, our ransom payer, and our redeemer. What does it mean, though, when we read in Galatians that Christ became a curse for us? We'll find out tomorrow as Dr. Sproul continues his series, The Atonement of Jesus. We hope you'll join us.